From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is now less than 2 weeks away from choosing its next president. Bush and Kerry, neck and neck, shoring up their bases and battling it out for those last few undecided voters from St. Petersburg to Seattle. But if the 2000 election and its angry fallout are any indication, the nation will not go to bed on November 2nd knowing who has won the White House. Armies of Republican and Democratic lawyers are standing by, poised to contest the outcome in critical counties and states across the nation on human error, disenfranchisement, technical foul-ups, vote tampering, anything, anywhere. Many election watchers expect a replay of Florida 2000 nationwide this time. The lawsuits, the recounts, the courts, the deeply unsettling prospect of another deeply disputed election result. If you thought Bush v. Gore was bad, this time it could be worse. Tonight on Point, assessing the risk of another disputed presidential election result just 13 days from now. You can join us. Do you think the nation will know who won the presidency on November 2nd? Or will this race, too, end up in the courts? Do you see cause for Election Day concern in your state, your town? And what will it take to give you confidence in the outcome on Election Day this year? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Elizabeth Schneider, researcher for electionline.org, part of the Election Reform Information Project. It's a nonpartisan website providing news and analysis on election reform. She's co-author of their recent report, Election Preview 2004, What's Changed, What Hasn't, and Why. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with me in the studio tonight, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you right here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
So, Elizabeth Schneider, take us along the waterfront, if you would. What should we be watching for? What are all those thousands of attorneys, Republican and Democrat, that we're told are out there lurking? What are they watching for in the run-up to and in the midst of this year's vote?
Sure. Well, there seem to be three major issues this year. One concerns, obviously, voting technology, the introduction of touchscreen voting machines in many states. While many states will still be using punch card ballots, optical scan, and lever machines. Another issue surrounds voter identification. Many states are making or will be requiring voters to show ID when they get to the polls. However, this varies state by state. There will be 17 states that are including Missouri, Florida, Colorado, and Louisiana that will require all voters to show some form of ID when they get to the polls. And the third major issue is provisional balloting. We've seen a host of lawsuits. Strictly from the four states right now are Colorado, Michigan, Florida, Ohio, and Missouri. And these lawsuits, while there have been some rulings, some still remain to be appealed, and probably more could be filed before on Election Day or after Election Day.
Elizabeth, what's the issue with provisional ballots? What is a provisional ballot, and why is it in the courts?
Sure. A provisional ballot became part of the law under the Help America Vote Act of 2002.
This was the response to the mess in 2000 that was supposed to bring reform.
Correct, correct. The provisional ballot is supposed to be provided to voters who, when they reach the polls, if their name does not appear on the voting rolls, that they will be then given a provisional ballot to cast their vote.
So if they show their ID but they're not on the list, so here's a provisional ballot, and then what happens?
Sure. Well, it depends on if that state is asking for ID. Again, this varies state by state.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, a voter goes to their precinct. They do not show up on the voter registration list. They are given a provisional ballot. They can vote on that. They sign an affidavit swearing that they are a registered voter and registered at that precinct, and then that ballot is set aside to be counted later.
Okay. So what's the issue?
The issue is because the way that HAVA was written, it was written very loosely so that states will and can and have interpreted the laws very differently. For instance, there are three main things going on with provisional balloting. Some states are saying that a voter must be in the correct precinct to cast their provisional ballot. If they are not in the correct precinct, that ballot will be thrown out. Some states have ruled that the voter must be in the correct county for that vote to count. And some states are saying if you're just in the wrong, and some states have said if you cast your ballot anywhere, that vote will count. The contentious issue is, when will a voter receive a provisional ballot? Are poll workers armed with the information to when to provide them with a provisional ballot, and will that provisional ballot count? And that's what you see in the courts right now.
Elizabeth, stand by. Jack Beatty, this provisional ballot issue is big because we had a lot of voters in the year 2000, in Florida in particular, but not only there, who felt that they'd been their vote had not been heard because they were pushed away from the polling place.
Yes, and some of those were people whose names were the same names as convicted felons in other states even than Florida. And in fact, on the list that the names were struck down from, 40-some thousand of them were not felons. And according to Greg Palast in the latest issue of Harper's Magazine, a surprising percentage of that 40-odd thousand has yet to be able to get the right to vote again. They went to the polls. They tried to vote. They tried to do a provisional ballot, and they said, sorry, you got the name of a felon. And Florida has yet, according to Harper's, to register these people whose names just happen to be the same, but who have no felonious record at all. So here's a case of, you know, right away, even before the election has begun, people are being excluded from the electorate wrongly, it seems to me.
So, Elizabeth Snyder, we're reading that there are something like 10,000 lawyers standing by for Democrats across the country, 2,000 in Florida, thousands of Republican attorneys as well. Is this the kind of issue that we're going to see suits filed on November 2nd? And could it actually tie up this outcome?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. That will remain to be seen if it does happen. I think the reason you're seeing, obviously, so many lawyers is because of what happened in 2000. Two, because this race has been predicted to be, you know, too close to call. And I think that's why, while everyone is saying we're going to make sure every vote counts, I mean, ideally, every vote should count, even if there's a wide margin between the two candidates. But this time, there's so much focus because of what happened in 2000, and I think neither party is too sure of what's going to happen. I think that's why they're preparing their lawyers for this.
Phalanxes of lawyers on either side, and of course, we know how that can tie things up. And surely, after 2000, people will be prepared to fight. Elizabeth Snyder at electionline.org. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure thing. Thank you.
I want to turn to a couple more guests now. In New York tonight, Nate Persley. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School and expert on election law. Nate Persley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
And with us from Los Angeles, Elizabeth Garrett, director of the University of Southern California Caltech Center on Law and Politics. Elizabeth Garrett, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth, first to you, if I may. What's your big fear around the disputed election outcome here? We see people on all sides just kind of white-knuckled about this and afraid that the most important, perhaps, vote that the country takes is going to once again come out snagged and snared up in controversy, and we won't have a clear outcome. Are you worried about that?
Well, I think we should be worried about having elections that are fairly run and competently run. But I have to say, at this point, my big worry is that we're all blowing this possibility out of proportion and reaching a kind of crisis mentality before there's any reason to do so. The chances that we're going to have another 2000 are very slim. Another 2000 means that we would have to have a very close race again in a state that makes a difference in the Electoral College vote. Now, that's possible. It's not an insignificant possibility, but it's also not a possibility that should bring us to sort of a hysterical level. And even if we did, I guess I don't worry too much that democracy is going to crumble. We did pretty well getting through 2000. It wasn't optimal. I would not have wanted the Supreme Court to have intervened in the way that they did.
Boy, a lot of people would dispute that kind of that kind of comfortable assessment of 2000, though. Al Gore graciously stepped aside. I don't know if he'd do it again. We could easily find a standoff here, couldn't we?
I don't think it's a comfortable assessment. I don't want in anyone.
We got through it pretty well. Democracy
didn't. Mess. Mm-hmm. Well, we did. Our democracy stood up pretty well to a test of our election procedures. As I said, I wish that the Supreme Court had not gotten involved because I think things would have worked out. Would have worked out had we continued to pursue the political approaches of solving a contested presidential election. We had the procedures in place to have dealt with it in Congress if it had gotten to that point. We did not need the Supreme Court to intervene. I actually think that our ability to work that out in a way that allowed us to continue governing and continue the democracy suggested the strength of the democratic system. And my guess is if something bad happens this year, we will again work it out. Hopefully, we will take a very strong and sober look at the electoral laws and try to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. But I think we can weather through whatever is thrown at us this election as we did in 2000.
Nate Persily, are you as sanguine as Elizabeth Garrett? I know a lot of people really on pins and needles about this vote, as close as the polls are showing it may be. And, of course, Elizabeth's right. It may very well not come down to a kind of Florida-style hinge on a few hundred or thousand votes. And yet, with so much attention focused on this on both sides, the odds of this getting deliberately thrown to the courts to slow down a result seem to be one option. How are you looking on to this, Nate?
Well, I hope Beth Garrett is right about this. While those of us who study election law profit off of this chaos in a certain respect, I think we as a nation are getting quite tired of it. And I think there were several other issues that your previous guest didn't mention. Issues dealing with fraud, issues dealing with absentee ballots, which I think are innovations this time and are quite different in kind than things that happened 4 years ago. But just on the general question of comparing this to the previous election, let's face it, something like 2000, the 2000 election, happens once every 200-some-odd years. And so we shouldn't expect it to happen again. The difficulty here, I think, is that there's a real risk that it's not going to be just 500 votes that people are going to be disputing, but it'll be tens of thousands of votes, because in some states you're going to have one out of four ballots that are going to be cast absentee. You're going to have the provisional ballot issue. You have a lot of states where absentee ballots are not going to be counted until a few days after the election. So while I want to echo Beth Garrett's call for us to sort of take a little bit of a breath here, because we don't want to sort of create a crisis of legitimacy before one actually appears, I think that, you know, we have to pay attention to all of these issues that are coming into the courts now.
But a lot of people would say that there was a crisis of legitimacy in 2000, and that's why their breath is bitter. They've already seen one, and the country, as many people have said in recent days, the country can't bear another.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, but for the 2000 election, we wouldn't have the race to the courts this time, because as Beth was explaining before, the in part, it's because of the Supreme Court's intervention last time that we're now seeing the courts as maybe the primary forums for us to deal with these disputes, as opposed to the state legislatures or the Congress. And so now that that path has been blazed, it's natural for the Republicans and the Democrats to rely upon it the second time around. But let me add one word of hope here, which is that better that these cases happen before the election than after. And so while we are necessarily complaining about all of these cases that are coming down the pike right now, there is a silver lining to this cloud, which is that in some of these states, over some of these issues, these controversies will be settled before the election as opposed to afterwards.
We'll come back and look at exactly how that might happen. Jack Beatty, we've got half a minute before the break. How are you feeling, Jack? What's your level of comfort about the courts and the possibility of a disputed election in 13 days?
I'm with the 58% of the public who expects a Florida-like mess. Look what would almost happen in 2000. If the GOP hadn't won there, they had put the Gore people on record. We were going to do a recount in New Mexico, 366 votes. We were going to do a recount possibly in Iowa. There was some talk about Wisconsin, a kind of regress from redoubt. We don't win here, we'll win there. And in where 2 or 3 or 10 electoral votes could swing the difference, actions in a couple of small states could tip the balance. So I expect a kind of rolling litigation. The Democrats have 10,000 lawyers.
That's a lot of lawyers, and the GOP has theirs as well. Jack, Nate Persily, Elizabeth Garrett, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the risk of a disputed election on November 2nd. You can join the conversation. What actionable foul-ups do you fear on Election Day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the risk of a disputed election in 13 days on November 2nd and the mess that would come after. You can join our conversation tonight. After the experience of 2000, will every close election now be challenged, disputed, questioned? What vulnerabilities in the system have you worried? Are you confident of voting procedures in your state, your city, your town? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Elizabeth Garrett at the University of Southern California Caltech Center on Law and Politics, by Nate Persily of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, an expert on election law. You can join the conversation as well. Nate Persily, I want to turn to you. You've outlined a number of scenarios. I don't know how you describe them, as nightmare scenarios or vulnerability scenarios. Where do you see potential problems arising on November 2nd? What are your antenna out for? What kind of mess might we get into here?
I think, as your previous guest explained, that the provisional ballot issue is the one that everyone is highlighting right now, because this is a problem that was created by the attempt to solve the previous problems of the 2000 election, so that we have a situation where you have a right to cast a provisional ballot but not a right to have it counted.
And who will decide if it's counted or not, and when?
It's decide. Well, this is an issue, in a sense, of state law, but it's now being litigated in five states. And so the way the courts have started to come down on this issue is that they're being quite liberal about it, allowing people who make the mistake of going into the wrong precinct to have it counted. But we have, you know, we have several other states that have yet to decide on this issue. Florida actually went the other way on that. They have a much more restrictive rule on provisional ballots. But I think that...
But put us on November 2nd. Are we going to be in a situation where we see the big TV anchor saying, well, we can't tell you what the outcome is tonight because provisional ballots are still out there and we don't know how they'll be counted or what their tally is?
That's possible. Not just provisional ballots, but also absentee ballots. I mean, just today, the Pentagon has announced that they're going to put an absentee ballot on the Pentagon website for overseas voters because they are afraid that the absentee ballots that have been mailed out to voters from several states are not going to get to them on time, so they won't be able to mail them back within the required legal deadline. And a lot of this is as a result of other litigation, such as the Nader litigation, which held up the distribution of the absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. As I was saying before, there is a possibility that in some states, one out of four ballots are going to be cast absentee. And you also have, as the reports have been coming in lately, questions about false registrations and these other allegations, principally that the Republicans are making, about fraudulent registrations and ones that would be challenged in the event it really comes to that.
And they're saying that the big registration drives are producing, I don't know, ghost voters. Or what does false registration mean?
That's right. That you know, in Ohio, Mary Poppins and Dick Tracy happened to ask for an absentee registration, right? And so the risk is that these absentee ballots will then be cast by someone who has already voted, or there'd be an organized campaign in order to get, ballots for a particular person.
And then there's been the allegation from the other side, as I understand it, that registrations have been just tossed out by sort of registration canvassers. If they don't end up in the right party, they're, you know, being thrown in a ditch.
Exactly. I mean, in many ways, that sounds like one of the most serious charges that's been made in the last few weeks it's a felony. I mean, if what is happening is that this company out of Arizona is alleged to have done sort of false voter registration drives where they ended up throwing out the registrations of Democrats but not Republicans. And so there are going to be people who come to the precinct and they say, look, I registered to vote. And then these people are going to be given a provisional ballot, because everyone's going to get a provisional ballot if their name is not on the rolls. And the question is, how do we resolve that type of dispute among the many other provisional ballot disputes we're going to have to reconcile.
And of course, there are other issues as well. We've heard them around technology, around potential fraud, barriers to access. But here's
Here's my question. After the contentiousness in 2000 and the bitter feelings left by that, and with this array of attorneys out there, Nate, personally, do you see two political parties ready, almost whatever the outcome, to pounce, to bring suits to the courts that will tie this up almost inevitably? Or is the eye of the needle that they're going to have to go through so small, as Elizabeth Garrett suggests, that they won't be in a position to tie up the outcome?
Well, again, it only depends if the margin of victory is sufficiently small that the kinds of claims we're talking about are going to make a difference. If the margin of victory in, say, the Electoral College is, 20, let's say 50 votes, something like that, then I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of this kind of litigation. My guess is that so long as it's not just one state which hangs in the balance, that then the wind will really be taken out of the lawyer's sails. I mean, what happened in 2000 is that it all came down to Florida. If, as it turns out, you've got to win a case in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida in order to tip the balance, even if you legitimately feel that you've been shafted because of administration of the election, I think it's going to be very hard to win that kind of fight.
And Elizabeth Garrett, you're feeling some confidence that we're not going to come down to that situation again. A lot of apprehension out there. If it should happen, how do you see the consequences for the electorate, for Americans' confidence in their voting procedures?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on how we react to it if it happens again. And let me be clear, I think there is a chance it will happen again in such a closely contested election, but I do not think the chance is more likely than not for the reasons that Nate just described.
Mm.
So I think it depends on how we respond to it. Do we respond to it by trying in an orderly fashion to deal with the litigation, to keep it as much as possible in the political branches? Does the Supreme Court stay out of it this time and allow the Congress to deal with any disputes in the Electoral College as was anticipated and as Congress is ready to do? And when it's over, do we take a very hard look at what went wrong and try to very proactively deal with it? The Help America Vote Act did try to deal with some of the problems with this provisional balloting, for example. But absentee balloting, which I agree with Nate, is one of the key areas of concern. Suddenly now, one in five of us is going to be voting on absentee. But we don't have rules. We haven't thought through what that means for voting. What does it mean for in terms of fraud? What does it mean in terms of coercion? What does it mean in terms of delivering those absentee ballots to the county registrars? It's very important that whenever we have one of these trends in elections, that we try to anticipate the problems and legislate and regulate. If we have problems, then we've got to respond after the contested election very strongly and very proactively. I'd like to see Congress appropriate a lot more money for education of electoral workers, for voter education, to help states get technology in shape. So I think that how this is, if in fact we have another contested election, how we respond will be crucial. If we respond in an orderly fashion, we try to get through these things and keep it in the political branches, I think we'll weather through this.
But Jack Beatty, you might say, for all the tension around it, as Elizabeth says, 2000 was fairly orderly in that people were ultimately willing to accept the court's decision. Al Gore was willing to step aside. There was a kind of for the greater good sense about it. Of course, a part of maybe the presumption in that was that it was such an outrageous situation that George Bush would then govern from the center and so on. He didn't. I don't know if Al Gore would make the same sort of gracious withdrawal from the stage again today. Did 2000 look orderly to you, Jack? Do you expect, should Americans be orderly if we get into that kind of situation again?
Well, orderly in the sense that we need to obey the law, but I think that if we got into that situation again where it was going to go to the Supreme Court, where Clarence Thomas, who was appointed by Mr. Bush's father, would cast one of the votes, where we basically know the people who would cast the votes, that is not a democratic procedure. That was a usurpation of a proper of authority properly resident with the states and the political branches. I'm terribly afraid of this scenario. We saw the media last time. We saw how they handled the Florida recount. It was he said, she said. That's
mm-hmm.
how they reported.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a gang of bullies, thugs, rushing people on an election, in an election site who are counting ballots, stopping the count.
This was the Tom DeLay organized crew that went into the voting center.
Yeah, and the count stops, and they don't resume it. And then you see a demonstration outside led by Jesse Jackson, you know, yelling, hail no, we won't go, whatever it was.
Right, right.
And you have the media say, well, now we have this demonstration here and we have that demonstration there. The very kinds of the very traps that the way the media is trapped by this myth of objectivity, it just inevitably goes in the direction of power. And I'm terribly afraid that with lots of lawsuits in lots of places, an international crisis could come along. I expect that Bush may even get a majority now, may even come out ahead in the popular vote, but lose in the Electoral College.
It's a possibility.
It's a possibility. I fear that the transfer of power, even if Kerry won, would be delayed and might even be prevented. In other words, I think the media can normalize almost any outrage. And that's what I'm afraid of, that we'll just kind of say, well, yeah, Justice Scalia should pick again, and that's how it should be. And that we'll all the Democratic Party in this country can't do that again. But if the court is in the bag for the Bush administration, and if Bush doesn't want to give up power, as I suspect he does not. I mean, the president said he has received messages from God to be president.
Nate Persley, we can all see how strong the emotions are running on both sides in this campaign. No one's going to want to give up lightly if there's any question about it. And, of course, lots of questions can be raised. If it's disputed, what's your level of confidence in an orderly outcome this time? Democrats a lot less likely to be so cooperative, I would think, after 2000. But the country's got a war going on in Iraq. George Bush, you know, may have reasons to say, folks, we can't deal with it. We can't handle this uncertainty. Let's X, Y, or Z. How do you anticipate it?
Well, I think they're, you know, in the event it is as close as 2000, there will be a race to the courthouse. And I mean, if what you're asking me is whether we are going to, in a sense, recede into the kind of status of a lot of developing nations where they protest elections, you know, the odds are against that. I think it does depend on how the formal institutions deal with this. Let me say something about the Supreme Court on this, because I actually have a different prediction as to how the Supreme Court would deal with this. I think they are very cognizant of how controversial their decision was in Bush versus Gore. I should say, just parenthetically, that just the former President Bush's appointees split on this, so that Justice Souter and Justice Thomas did not both go with President Bush in this case. But that I think that you know, Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy, in particular, are cognizant of how controversial this was, and I don't think you can necessarily predict it ex ante as to what would happen. I think that there is a greater potential for violence this time than last time. However, it does depend on what the nature of the controversy is. I think that it depends on what kind of accusations are being hurled this way or that.
And how do we avoid the feeling, the kind of bum's rush feeling that a lot of people had last time, that, you know, in the nation is naturally desires, as Elizabeth says, an orderly transfer of power. Everyone wants that and understands that that's important for the state, for the democracy, and yet that can be exploited. How do we resist a kind of bum's rush feeling?
Well, I do agree that the media has a strong role to play here, and for that matter, all of us who comment on this are in part trying to keep the heart rate down here. I think that, you know, it's very difficult to say in the abstract how we're going to do this. I think that it is natural in a highly polarized electorate where people have strong feelings about the candidates for them to believe that they should win at all costs. Especially when the stakes are as high as they are now. Now, the stakes in 2000 did not seem as high. I mean, the issues in the election were not as salient. And so the costs of going with Bush as opposed to Gore didn't seem, or costs or benefits didn't maybe seem as severe. Now, people do see serious costs and benefits. I think it's up to the political leaders in particular, the moderates, people like John McCain and some conservative Democrats, to play a brokering role.
And yet the parties don't seem to be going in that direction. On the contrary, they seem to be putting out their array of attorneys ready to pounce in a litigious direction.
Well, that's what happens before
the array of attorneys. You know, one of the good things I think that's happening in this election is a lot of those attorneys are not just waiting to bring litigation after the fact, but they're proactively monitoring what's happening during early voting. They'll monitor what happens on election day, and they'll try to intervene when things can still be done to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we didn't have in 2000. When people were turned away from the poll, there wasn't a lawyer there to help them get back in and cast a ballot.
So hope in that you're seeing.
Well, I think so. Again, I think we have to be really careful about making claims like an international crisis following this.
We have an international crisis, essentially, you could say, already in Iraq, do we not? I mean, that's not so hypothetical.
Absolutely.
Well, what do you mean by claim?
Situation, but one of your guests, not Nate, said that what we might have was an international crisis and some kind of a crisis that would spill out of our borders and affect the world.
Pointing out our news analyst, Jack Beattie, referred to an international crisis, but you could say that we do have one extant in Iraq, even as we go into the election season.
The
so it's not exactly far-fetched.
The election is going to spill out and exacerbate some kind of an international crisis. My guess is that we are going to be able to handle whatever happens in this election through the processes that are established. Hopefully the processes this time will not include the Supreme Court, will include the political branches only. And hopefully the kinds of things that we're doing now before the election and during the election will avert some of those difficulties.
And I should say, we all say amen to that. Everybody hopes for a very credible and orderly transfer of power. It's just that we saw 2000. We can't forget so quickly, and it was pretty alarming. Let's take some calls. Darren's calling from Riverdale, New York. Hi, Darren. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Great.
Fascinating
thanks.
Debate. This is terrific. I just wanted to say, you know, that maybe the 2000 election wasn't a crisis of legitimacy, but that crisis already existed. And the 2000 election, really, the scales just fell from our eyes, and we saw the problems which were endemic to our voting system. And I would suggest that instead of taking the pejorative view that it seems that you and many of your guests are taking, is in fact, I think that what is going on with all of the with the presence of all the attorneys shows how our system works. It suggests that when there are these kind of deep problems in the democratic process,
yes,
there are resolutions there. The attorneys are the people who have the capacity to analyze the law, to argue the law. I mean, that's what our Constitution is about.
You're exactly right there, and I've got to cut you because we've got a break coming up here, and I see what you're saying, and Elizabeth says the same thing. These attorneys could head off problems. I don't mean to disparage the attorneys. I just pointed out, as a matter of fact, that these are lots of legal eagles ready, if necessary, to bring suit that could get us in a heck of a tangle here. But Nate, personally, Darren says what it's done is point out that we've got some real problems with the election system overall. And how far do you think we've come in addressing those since 2000?
I actually think we've made the problems worse, that the attempts to fix the 2000 election have introduced a whole set of new problems, and that is in principle principally the provisional ballot issue, but also some of the ID requirements dealing with that, as well as the fact that there are huge transition costs when you move to these new technologies. Now, one thing that let me echo something that Beth was saying before. A lot of the problems that we're identifying here arise from two major factors. One, which is that we have partisan appointees or elected officials who are the administrators of these elections.
Mm-hmm.
The second is those who are administering the polling places are volunteers who are not really trained. You tackle those two problems, you'll be able to solve a lot of these other ancillary problems that we're talking about.
We've got to take a short break. Elizabeth Garrett at University of Southern California, Caltech Center on Law and Politics, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
We are talking about the risk of a disputed election on November 2nd. What do you think? What's your confidence in a clear, clean outcome 13 days from today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the risk of a disputed election on November 2nd and the mess that would come after. Nobody wants to see a disputed election, but it happened in 2000. There are a lot of people watching very closely, and we have a very tight race. It's only 13 days away now. It deserves some attention. You can join the conversation tonight. Does it make you sick as an American to have to worry not only about the outcome of the election, but about its legitimacy? And how big a margin of victory will a candidate need this year to be seen as winning clear and free beyond dispute? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, tonight from the University of Pennsylvania Law School, by Nate Persley. He's an expert on election law. And right now, by Arthur Applebaum. He's professor of ethics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Arthur Applebaum, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
I wish you'd speak, if you could, to this issue of legitimacy. The country's patience was tried in 2000, to say the least, and for some people there remain legitimacy issues out of that election season. What are the risks? You specialize, I think, in looking at what it takes to produce a legitimate winner seen as legitimate. What are the risks you see on November 2nd?
Well, Tom, there's a difference between producing a winner who is legitimate, by which we can mean having the genuine right to govern, and a named winner who is seen to be or perceived as legitimate. And certainly it's vastly more important that we be governed by the person who has the right to govern us than be governed by the person who we think has the right to govern us, because we could be mistaken.
So don't just go for appearances. All right.
And if it turns out that what would give someone the genuine right to govern? It would involve probably some combination of two things. One is that we have election laws that are by themselves genuinely legitimate, which means that they give citizens a fair, or at least an adequate share of political liberty, and that these laws be faithfully adhered to. If it turns out that we have failed at either one or the other, then rightly so, the election should end up in the courts. And I think your last caller, Darren, got it exactly right. If it turns out that there are serious problems in the election, it is better to litigate it and suffer the uncertainty than to make believe that, in fact, we're being properly ruled when, in fact, we're not.
So, but you're seeing this as part of a disputed but orderly aftermath of a vote where the outcome was challenged. You're saying we just have to sit tight, be patient, let it work through the courts.
Absolutely right. And if it turns out that we have lost, as many of us thought that in the last election, the courts made a mistake, then it's up to us as citizens to change the election laws to close certain loopholes and close ambiguities. But there's no way around the fact that in the end, what we have to do is make sure that people have their fair share of political liberty, which means that people get a chance to vote. That means there ought to be a presumption in favor of inclusion. You know, in the bad old days, there was good reason to worry about fraud, and Democratic Party politics in the big cities was probably rightly accused of. In Chicago, the joke was the Lake Michigan vote.
Are you going back what to 1960 Kennedy Nixon even?
Certainly then, and of course before that. Now again, this is a factual matter, but now the danger is probably more in the direction of excluding people who ought to be included rather than including people who ought to be excluded. And certainly there ought to be a presumption in favor of inclusion. This is true ever since the Supreme Court said in 1964 that our fundamental ideas of democratic government require one person, one vote, and require this kind of inclusion.
And where do you see the biggest danger of exclusion?
Well, you can worry about voter fraud, and what one party is doing is insisting that the serious danger here is fraud. Well, there's a way of reducing fraud to near zero. You could require that every voter appear with two witnesses and a DNA test and register 3 years before. You could eliminate fraud, but obviously that would also eliminate something else. I believe that we're at a stage in our political development and a stage in the risks on either side where it's vastly more important and more leaning towards legitimate government if we adopt policies and laws that help people to vote, rather than worry as much as some people are worrying about the wrong people getting a chance to
vote. You're
kind
of dancing around. You're saying the Republicans.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, you're saying you've got Republicans who are more vigorously challenging people's right to vote.
Yes.
And you're saying worry more about getting them to vote.
That's right.
Let's get a caller in here. Amy is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I want to say that I feel like our system is already broken, and maybe we're, instead of jumping the gun, we're a little too late. Some of these problems I think are new and some are old. New ones having to do with, like, electronic voting. We have the CEO of Diebold that makes a lot of the Vogue machines bundling over $100,000 in contributions for George Bush, talking in a letter that was accidentally made public about delivering Ohio's electoral votes to Bush in November. You know, we had Chuck Hagel won a Senate race in Nebraska where the company that he had formerly been CEO of was counting the votes. You know, Maryland's red team that was like an official sort of hacker group to look for problems with their electronic voting systems was able to end elections early, reassign votes. So I think that raises some major problems. And I continue to see problems of inclusion. For example, that felons and prisoners can't vote. You know, I feel like we should have voting machines right in the prison, since crime and prisoners are made to be such a political issue.
Amy, let me ask you, did you have these concerns before the 2000 debacle, or is this post-2000 concern for you?
Well, I suppose those are sort of newer concerns for me as I've gotten, as I've learned more about this issue. But even before 2000, I've always seen the Electoral College as a major barrier to a true democracy. There should never, in my mind, in a democracy, be a situation where somebody wins the popular vote and loses the Electoral College. It's a perversion of the one-person, one-vote principle.
It sure doesn't feel good. Amy, thanks very much for calling. Nate Persley, let me put this electronic voting question straight to you. Are you feeling comfortable with the credibility and the dependability of the vote that we're going to get out of the many touchscreen voting machines that are now dispersed?
One of the interesting things about this controversy is that about 6 or 7 months ago, this is all we were talking about, which is we were talking about the possibility of partisan manipulation of the voting machines or hackers or that they would malfunction. I actually think that this is about number 5 on my list of concerns. I actually think it's going to be relatively low in its potential for mischief, but it is a real concern. And I actually think let me reframe this problem in a little bit different way, which is that the transitions to the new technologies are the things we really have to worry about. One of the things that the Caltech MIT report found out of the 2000 elections is that the differences between good counties and bad counties was larger than the difference between good technologies and bad technologies.
So it's the way it's used, you're saying?
Well, that a good administrator with a bad technology, like a punch card machine, will often count the votes more accurately than a bad administrator with the touchscreen technology, or not the touchscreen, but a more advanced technology.
Right.
For example, let me just – this is a story most people don't know about. In the 2002 gubernatorial primary in Florida, this was the first time Miami-Dade used their touchscreen technology. And they had these spiffy new computers that were in the precincts. But, of course, the volunteers who were administering the elections, many of whom had never really been familiar with a computer before, didn't realize you had to plug in these laptops. So after 2 hours out in the polls, like any other laptop, they end up dying. And no one wanted to touch it because they didn't want to be the Teresa Lepore of the 2002 election.
It's funny, but it makes you want to cry. Colin's calling from Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Colin. You're on the air.
Yes. You know, when I heard one of your guests say earlier that she hoped that this would not wind up in litigation but would be settled by the constitutional process, which called for the House of Representatives to settle a dispute,
yes,
it sent a chill down my spine. The House of Representatives, she thinks that's going to settle something? The House of Representatives, from what I've heard lately, is the most partisan of all of our democratic institutions. They don't submit bills to the Senate for negotiations.
So that's no comfort to you these days, no Council of Greybeards. They're calling, our time is short. But Nate, let me put that to you. Describe for us, in what circumstances could this vote end up in the House, and what do you imagine coming out of it if it did?
Well, when people talk about the political processes taking hold of this as opposed to the courts, there are really three principal actors. You're talking about the state legislatures, the governors, and the House of Representatives, and for that matter also the Senate. It would take a little bit long for me to explain how the Electoral Count Act works, but in the event of controversies over a slate of electors, there is this law called the Electoral Count Act, which was passed in the late 1800s, which does give the House of Representatives, not just the Electoral Count Act, but in effect the Constitution itself, that gives the House of Representatives a particular role in deciding on what the proper slates of electors are. Now, I agree with your caller, which is that we've now reached a stage where the political branches are hardly the ones to be trusted in this, but we also don't know what the facts on the ground will be at the time. And will it be the kind of thing where the sort of exploitation of partisanship would be seen as so illegitimate that even, you'd have a significant number of defections in the House?
So you're saying people might rise to the occasion because it's so important when you come around to electing a president, and yet it's also so impassioned along partisan lines at just that time. Arthur Applebaum, our time is very short here, but do you see Americans' general sense of legitimacy and polling on the line on November 2nd?
It's entirely possible that if we have a litigated election that is prolonged, people start to wonder whether or not we have a fair system of elections. But you know what, Tom, maybe that's the right thing to wonder, because if this thing in fact does enter prolonged, protracted litigation and the court cases have merit, then maybe it is in fact the case that we don't have a fair system of election. And it's better to find that out than make believe that it isn't the case.
And maybe have not fixed it since 2000. Arthur Applebaum, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Arthur Applebaum, professor of ethics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Nate Persily at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Beatty, 13 days and counting. All this is a possibility. It's a little scary. Last word goes to you.
Well, 13 days plus, perhaps.
Yeah. Plus 36, plus, who knows what we'll decide.
Exactly.
Oh, boy, what a picture. Listeners, in a moment, George Bush and John Kerry campaigning today in the Hawkeye State. This is On Point. Iowa took center stage today in presidential politics as George Bush and John Kerry spent much of the day courting the Hawkeye State and its 7 electoral votes. Kerry tore into the president in Waterloo, saying the war in Iraq was a diversion from the war on terror and has left the United States with 2 wars to fight. Bush blasted away in Mason City, saying his opponent has a, quote, fundamental misunderstanding of the war in Iraq.
You cannot lead our nation to decisive victory on which the security of every American family depends if you do not see the true dangers of a post-September the 11th world.
The president's failures in Iraq, my friends, have made us, as Admiral Stansfield Turner just said, have made us weaker, not stronger, in the war on terrorism. That is the hard truth that America needs to consider in these next days.
Iraq is no diversion, but a central commitment in the war on terror, a place where our military is confronting and defeating terrorists overseas so we do not have to face them here at home.
If the president cannot recognize the problems in Iraq, he will not fix them. I do recognize them, and I will fix them.
The next commander-in-chief must lead us to victory in this war. And you cannot win a war when you don't believe you're fighting one.
The president says he's a leader. Well, Mr. President, look behind you. There's hardly anyone there. It's not leadership if we haven't built the strongest alliance possible and if America is going almost alone.
This unchanged worldview becomes obvious when he calls the war against terror primarily an intelligence and law enforcement operation rather than what I believe. A war which requires the full use of American power to keep us secure.
14 days from this very moment, Americans will have been to the polls, and I know that you came here tonight to give George W. Bush his 2-week notice.
John Kerry and George W. Bush both campaigning in Iowa, the president in Mason City, and his challenger in Waterloo. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Lauren Madelon, Chris O'Connor, Cora Peterson, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. From the studios of Boston University, this is On Point.